Check for pulse. If no pulse, start CPR.
All right. Welcome back to CITR 101.9 FM. You are listening to The Arts Beat, formerly The Arts Report, on CITR 101.9 FM. Today is Wednesday, March 19th. Tomorrow's the first day of spring. And we are broadcasting to you live from the University of British Columbia, Vancouver campus. First and foremost, we'd like to acknowledge that UBC is the unceded ancestral lands of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people, whose traditional territory once spanned roughly 1,500 square kilometers. Today, the Musqueam Reserve is just under 3 square kilometers. The land here was never given up to the Crown, but was rather stolen without plans for repatriation. This is reflected today by the University Endowment Lands, which occupies over 4 times the size of the Musqueam Reserve. UBC itself trained residential school legislators and administrators, playing a major part in these histories. Being part of the Arts Collective at CITR and being able to be here talking about art and culture in this space is a privilege, and we seek to create meaningful dialogue, uplift disenfranchised voices, and disrupt institutional knowledge production in the small ways that we can. Art, music, and media, including radio, are all inherently political, and as Indigenous voices in so-called Canada have been systematically devalued and diminished from these spaces, we'd like to point you to the great work of Unceded Airwaves from CITR's Indigenous Collective. My name is Serena. I'm your host, and I'm joined in the studio today by some incredible, lovely people. If you guys want to say hi.
Hello, I'm Django.
Hi, I'm Maya, number one.
I'm Maya, number two.
I'm Mickey, number one.
Hi, I'm Ava.
I'm Lily.
I'm Margo.
And we have a special guest here today, too.
I'm Connor.
All right, guys. Thank you so much for thank you so much for all being here. We're continuing our discussion today of art in the institution and how those two weave in and out of each other. This is the third episode of our limited series, third and three quarters of the way through, because we're doing 4 episodes. So our limited series, Everything But the Piece. And we have some awesome content to get into today. We're going to be talking about a Banksy exhibition. We're going to be talking about the MOA again, resuming our conversation about that. We're also going to be talking about independent artist-run spaces, such as the James Black Gallery. So I'm really excited to get into it. And I think that I want to just take a second to say that this is going to be a bit of a transitional episode, and that our next episode is going to focus a little bit more heavily on art as resistance. So yeah, I'm super excited to get into it. Django, would you like to introduce the exhibit that we went to?
Yeah, so yesterday me and Serena went to The Art of Banksy Without Limits in Gastown. It was put on by some random events. I don't even know. It's like
a touring.
Touring exhibit that's they advertise has served 2.1 million people around the world,
which
it's his first time in Vancouver. And I believe Serena interviewed the promoter of it.
Yeah, absolutely. So I had the privilege of doing a remote interview with Serena Varekalu, who is the producer, I think she called herself, of the exhibition, which is really cool. So I have a little snippet of an interview of just in her own words introducing the exhibition and what they seek to do with the Banksy situation. So we're going to get into that, and then we're going to kind of round out our discussion and talk about our personal experience at the exhibition. So let's get into that.
I am from Romania, but nowadays being from a certain country doesn't matter so much anymore. I'm global, I could say. I'm a global citizen. And I'm a promoter here in Romania, so I have a background and experience about organizing events since 1997. I used to work also during my university, so 1997, meaning when I absolved the university. But since 2000, I'm on my own, and always from all my life I did events. And with in time, I became one of the most relevant promoters here in Romania, then in Europe, and then all over the world, by collaborations with various artists or various entertainment companies from all over the world. And since 2019, I joined this group of producers organizing this exhibition about Banksy. And since then, since 2019, step by step, we started to invest in our collection of Banksy, and to develop all over the world this legacy exhibition about Banksy. Currently, at this very moment, we opened approximated, me personally, I opened approximated 32 exhibitions in the world. And we visited all continents excepting Africa and Antarctica. And we are now in Vancouver after we visited for the first time Montreal, and then London in Ontario. And we are happy to be for the first time as well in Vancouver. We will be there until end of May. Because we see that the exhibition has a very good reaction to the public. Yeah, so the public is reacting very well to the exhibition. I think that we will extend the exhibition, so you would be like the first publication, the first media to find out that we are considering to extend the exhibition. I could say that how you'll see the next weekend you're visiting, that the attendees can expect an engaging and enlightening experience that includes a mix of original works, high quality reproduction, interactive installations like the in premiere in Canada. We are using only in Canada this installation, the hologram about Banksy, and compiling the video documentary that provides insight into the Banksy's life and work. It's a documentary made with the real Banksy, of course, that nobody can see him. It's only from the back. And we hope that people understanding every artworks and every message behind each artwork of Banksy will become a better person, and therefore our legacy to change the world in into a better world will be accomplished.
Thank you so much for that introduction. I'm just still wondering how involved Banksy is in the whole process of the exhibition, and where the artist comes in on this. So if you could shed a little bit of light on that.
He's not involved. Yeah, it's basically we are presenting, as I told you, our collection. Yeah, put in place like a show, and that's why I said that it's an educational event out of which people can understand. That's why he's so special into the world of the street artists. We didn't find too adversity from the public. Never, we never found, because he puts, even if it's in a strong manner, he highlights in a very sarcastic sometimes, yeah, way, the real values of humanity. Sometimes he's very critical for the politicians and for the wars that are happening. For me personally, he creates a big sadness when he's presenting about wars and especially about the children died in these unfaithful wars in the world. And for that, we didn't see any adversity coming from the public. I would like to add that most probably everybody knows that Banksy is an anonymous. Yeah, it's an anonymous entity, and although the remains anonymous and does not officially endorse the exhibitions. Yeah. Our exhibition it's carefully curated and celebrates the his immense immense influence on contemporary art and culture. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Bye. Bye.
All right, I want to say a huge thank you to Serena for that interview. And yeah, so that was just her introducing the exhibition in her own words. And now we're going to get into a little bit of our experience at the exhibition. Django, do you have any thoughts on hearing the interview?
Yeah, there's a few things that I needed to like check myself with first. And the first was to like take away any preconceived ideas I had of Banksy as a like an artist from me throughout my life interacting with his art. And I think the big one was like the one that stands out for me for Banksy is the shredding of that painting of the girl.
Super
And
cool.
like his the type of stuff that he's done has kind of been replicated by a lot of people. And I think going into that, I needed to realize that that bias that I had on him was mainly because of how he's been perceived throughout like media as a whole in the last 20 years or whatever.
Do you mean you had like a positive bias or like a
I had a
negative
negative,
bias?
I will say. And so I knew that this thing that we were going to was not endorsed by him. And so I was really interested to see how that one mixed in. And one thing that I will say that I found really positive is they don't shy away from his political messaging in any of
Yeah,
his artwork,
that's true. They
which
really
was,
were like very supportive of him as like a political artist.
which I think is very important to show people in a
Yeah.
context like this, where it's something that is not endorsed by him. But they're not stripping back that like political messaging behind any of his work. And that was something that as someone who is always kind of, I don't want to say cringed at his art or anything like that, but it has definitely been played out by maybe other people.
Well, yeah, I mean, like what I found out is that his first exhibition, or like the first time his work was kind of, maybe not first exhibition, but like the first time people were seeing and appreciating his work and putting a name to it was in 1999.
Yeah.
So that is 26 years ago. So it kind of like, it's almost inevitable that it's played out now. Like he's gotten so famous over the last 30 years. Like, of course,
Yeah.
some of it's going to end up being kind of,
Stripped back of that
yeah.
original meaning. And that's something that you see with a lot of artists too. And he's a different example where because he's anonymous, it's kind of like his art almost gets a whole different side. It kind of spreads in this like way that's maybe not so natural or not as
It's like the
relative to
cult
other
of
artists.
personality,
Yeah.
like, yeah.
But when you'll see with someone, an example that I always think about is like Keith Haring, when he passed away, you'll see his artwork on like Uniqlo shirts
Oh
or
my God,
H&M
the
shirts.
Urban Outfitters,
Yeah.
like, merch.
But it's just, it's like, there's it's so far removed from these things that he was very passionate about
I
and
totally
very
agree.
like making
We should
commentary
do an
on.
episode on
Yeah,
that.
that would be an interesting thing to cover. So that being said, I was very happy with how Banksy's art was interpreted in this exhibit that is not endorsed by him, that they were still keeping the meaning to some of this artwork.
Totally. Yeah, I want to go off of what you're saying there with I also knew that it wasn't endorsed by him going into it, but what I didn't know was that he had so many exhibitions that he had
Yes,
endorsed. I
yeah.
wasn't aware of that because one of the things that they did in the exhibition is like the first room that you go into is basically just like posters outlining like a timeline of his art. Like there's not like the first room doesn't have any pieces. It's just like information essentially. And I didn't realize, but he's done a ton of like sorry, a ton of like actual exhibitions that he is putting his name on. They're at actual galleries, institutional spaces, to, you know, use our word of the day. But I definitely always understood Banksy as like a street artist, and I knew that he would kind of he had this like guerrilla technique of like putting it wherever and like invading on, you know, people's technically like private property or whatever. But I didn't realize that he had so many actual just like straight up exhibitions as well, which is like, it puts this one in like kind of a different context for me, because it's like, oh, theoretically he could have been on board with this, but he isn't, which is just kind of interesting. But that was one of the things that she was saying when we were talking, is that like, this is all from her and her co-producers' personal collections. Like, they have bought all this art and are exhibiting it as like their collection, which to me, to be honest, I don't feel like I got that undertone. I didn't see it like walking into it. I wasn't like, oh, this is someone's personal collection of Banksy work. Like,
yeah,
they didn't have their personal input into it, really, if that makes sense.
It felt like it was, to me, even though she's said in this interview, and like I'm looking at the website, and it is not very clear that it is not associated with him. In the reviews, it's like, oh, so glad Banksy came to Vancouver. And so there's a lot of this maybe choosing to not fully acknowledge the fact that, or like choosing to be okay with people believing it's kind of like, that it's Banksy coming.
Yeah, it's like, is it a lie or is it what you just don't say or whatever, right? Because of course, like, she was completely upfront with it when we're talking, but I do think that if you call it like the unofficial Banksy exhibition, people are gonna talk about it differently, and it might not get as much traction as it would otherwise.
Yeah.
Pivoting the conversation completely, just to some of the things that I noticed actually with Banksy's work. Like, obviously I knew he was very political, and like, he is, I think, originally based out of London.
Bristol.
Okay, thank you. But what I didn't realize was his like really long-standing support for Palestine. He's been doing works about Palestine since like 2017, and he's also done works in Ukraine. He like actually went there and like painted things, which is really incredible. And he also bought a ship in 2020 using his, like, you know, the money he made off of these actually like Sotheby's auctions of his work, used that money to buy a lifeboat called the MV Louise Michel Rescue Lifeboat. It was an old French Navy ship, and it patrols the Mediterranean Sea to save refugees, like save migrant refugees. Here, I'll show you guys the photo of it. But like, he fully financed that and is like financing the mission of it, which is really interesting. And I think that for me personally, moving slightly away from the exhibition and more towards Banksy and who he is and what he does, like, that's something that I found so meaningful, is that he's kind of like, you know, putting his actions behind his words or whatever. I believe in the resistance of art. I believe in the power of art just as art. But I also really love that, like, the money he's making off of his extreme reputation, he is actually like taking huge actions. Like, that's an amazing thing to do.
Yeah, and I think that really goes back to what you were talking about earlier, Django, because when we hear about Banksy in the media, it's always about these like big stunt moments, like the shredding of the painting. And I have never heard about like his actual actions like this. Like, that's an incredibly moving like thing that he's done. And I would have loved if there was more media coverage of that. And I think it just talks about how once art enters the media, it just takes on a whole nother meaning and kind of, as you said, just really can drift away from what it really was in the beginning.
No, yeah, I just want to call back a little bit to something we were talking about last episode, where Maya was mentioning the zine exhibition at the Museum of, sorry, the Vancouver Art Gallery, and how there was that kind of like dissonance with it, where it's like, oh, zines are these like incredibly political and counterculture things. And I think it's really interesting that this is like Banksy. He isn't a sellout. Like, he's proven that by, you know, using his millions of dollars to buy a lifeboat. Like, he's doing what he cares about and what he values, but then there's also this like whole other side of it where like the art world, as the like commodifying force that it is, just inherently, like, it's going to kind of negate that on some level. And you're right, like, I had no idea about that, but I've seen tons of his work, and I, you know, I know the name, I know the like cliche of him, but I do want to appreciate, like, I do appreciate what Serena was saying about how it is like supposed to be to some extent an educational experience for people. And I'll agree that for me it was educational. Like, I learned a lot about Banksy on a level above just his art. And like, you know, I found that a lot of the plaques that we're talking about, the works, were focused so much less on, like, I don't know, when you go to like a regular gallery and you're reading a plaque and it's like, this was painted in this year, and, you know, this is portraying this kind of scene or whatever. And it was so much more about the context that it was found in or like stuff like that. Does that make sense? Like,
yeah,
it wasn't talking about specifically what the art was, but like the whole like overwhelming context around it. So yeah, I definitely learned a lot, me personally.
I will say though that I did notice some hypocrisy just in like my whole experience of going to this thing where it was situated in Gastown, and then going there and having some of the plaques talk about Banksy critiquing the commodification of art or how we consume art. And I was in this very
really like paradoxical.
Yeah, it was super on the nose. It's like, oh, I'm looking at this art that this guy has created, making fun of the consumption of art while I'm at this thing that is put on not by him, but someone who has bought his art to then sell to people to buy tickets to this thing.
I also just want to say like there was a lot more reproductions than there was.
Yeah, there was like one that we found or two, or there was like the banknotes were real and stuff. But yeah. But just that whole, like, it was so in front of my face the whole time. And like then it going on to like ticket prices and stuff. Like me and Serena, which is kind of awesome, we got to make t-shirts.
Super awesome.
And if we had purchased those tickets, they would have been $75.
Yeah.
Yeah, but then the one thing that really, really, really stood out to me is right when we left, there was a construction site across the street.
Like right next, I'm so glad that you're bringing this up because this was like, it was so interesting. Like we went through this really just so crazy experience and like, you know, like she said, there was holograms and there was like these like interactive rooms and you're seeing like, you know, like clips of films and you're seeing like recreated scenes. Like there was a whole like section about like the art he did in Ukraine and they had set it up as kind of like a
war-torn
so it's like just this really like it's also a massive exhibit.
It was huge.
Like it's like two stories, it's huge. And so you walk out of this experience and we're walking through Gastown early in the afternoon and we see this like graffiti on a sign on a construction site and Django
I'll try and put this into words. It's a map of the area that we're in, of Gastown, specifically Blood Alley. And there's a You Are Here star in the zone that we're standing on the construction site. It's one of those like...
Like it's like a map of what thing. The development's yeah, what going the development's to be. Does that make sense? Like a tarp on the... Yeah.
And over Blood Alley are the words, WTF happened to all of us here, with a frowny face. And like
For
this,
the record, it didn't say WTF.
Yeah. And... It was right when we left the exhibit, and it was, like, the first thing that my eyes were drawn to, and it was a very, like, surreal moment of just, like, everything kind of, like, crashed down at once of where, like, where I was and what I had just seen in this place that was, has changed so rapidly in such a quick amount of time.
And is actively changing, right? This is on, like, to-be-constructed site,
mm-hmm.
and it was, and it's, like, I think that was, honestly... really special to see and to reconnect with the material and like apart from some of the problems I had with the exhibition to reconnect with the work of Banksy mm-hmm. and his resistance work that he actually does truly do and to see the power of street art in the very most like casual sense mm-hmm. like this was literally drawn with a Sharpie it wasn't the whole Banksy stencil situation but sometimes you don't need that right like his work is really cool and powerful and you know, iconic, but also like someone writing a heartfelt message, like what happened to us here? Like you're taking over Blood Alley and you're building this like apartment complex.
Yeah.
And then the Stussy store also has moved to like a larger location in Gastown. And it's just like, you know, this like pilgrimage that you do to the exhibition and back from it. And I don't know, I'd be curious to talk to some other people that had gone to the exhibition. I saw it was mostly like, tourists or like you know there was like some older people we did go early in the morning you know whatever but I wonder if other people were kind of grappling with this dissonance or if it was just from you know the perspective that we were coming from but seeing that was really impactful I want to transition our conversation a little bit to talk about this kind of concept of the middleman And obviously, like, we're seeing Banksy's work, which we, you know, most likely would never be able to see, even if it is a reproduction. It is cool to have, like, a face-to-face moment with this. But it is in a very, like, supremely managed way, and it is in a very commercial sense. And art has long been managed. Like, it's been, you know, historically, I think that there's this idea of, like, the purity of art and, like, oh, the power of art. And I'm not saying that that doesn't exist, but I also think that it's a bit of a myth that art has ever really existed in an unfiltered sense. So I'm going to point it to Maya here now to talk a little bit.
Yeah, no, I mean, patronage, what a long-standing concept. I mean, it's not really something we think about in today's art world as we kind of transcend into holograms and insane body art and things like that. But it's been around for a long time. You know, it goes back around 4,000 years. And just to get a little specific here, patronage can be referred to as, like, the support, encouragement, or financial aid of any individual or organization that gives something to someone else. But art patronage is, like, the official, like, financial support of art making. And it can also be, you know, commission, that type of thing. And, you know, it really started back in ancient Mesopotamia. And portrait statues were commissioned by royalty that looked just like them, so they could put them in their beautiful, ornate homes. And then to the west of that, in Egypt, artists were patronizing, I guess, pharaohs to create temples, massive sculptures, and, like, ornate mausoleums. And at this time, really, art patronage stood as a promotional material for the ruling class and continued to be that way for a really long time. Then it moves on to, you know, Europe and kings and queens, etc. And then, you know, the 19th century is where artists really began to break that old tradition of patronage. You know, they started getting higher stakes in their work, doing more art for themselves. And I'm sure this is for many reasons, more free time due to, you know, differing circumstances of life. But it's really here in the 19th century where, you know, big expressionist movements kind of were born and art took on a new life of its own. And then that kind of brings us to today, right? 21st century patronage, you can see it everywhere. You can see it online, Etsy, for example. Patreon, I don't know.
Patreon, yeah, seriously.
Patreon, but, you know, of course, governments themselves are also patrons of the arts in some way. They're funding galleries like, you know, City of Vancouver funds the Vancouver Art Gallery. There's cultural initiatives and arts councils, businesses and corporations also, and educational institutions, universities.
Yeah, I just want to once again do a little callback to last episode where Ava was able to shed some light on the kind of ways that UBC is an artistic and, like, cultural institution, but also has to have, like, so many different roles to play. And I think Mickey's going to get into a little bit more of a discussion with that, talking about the MOA here.
Yeah. So I'll repeat just for last week, just to catch you up to speed. But I had a conversation with Dr. Jennifer Kramer, who has a joint position. She's an associate professor in the Department of Anthropology at UBC, and then she's also a curator at the Museum of Anthropology, responsible for the Pacific Northwest Coast collections. So Jennifer stresses the importance of collaboration, saying that curators at MOA do not claim to have the authority to interpret indigenous treasures and belongings, but instead work with the communities to ensure accurate and respectful representation. She reflects on the nature of curating itself, suggesting that any exhibition, whether in an anthropology or art museum, is ultimately a creative process, a representation that will never fully capture the entire truth. She sees curating as an ongoing dialogue with the community and a process of learning and growth, acknowledging that curation, whether for typical gallery art or anthropology, is a form of creative fiction, representing reality but never fully capturing it.
That's, like, such an interesting thought, and I feel like that's a really powerful consideration to have as a curator, is that, like, there's no way for this to be the full picture of anything. Like, you're seeing one object, and even if you're seeing the true actual object, because it's decontextualized, you're not gonna understand all of the history and complexity that goes into that.
So, yeah, that's a great point. It was one of the first things that I asked was, how does the museum receive funding? Just because I was curious. I guess my assumption was just that, like, I guess a little naive, but I just assumed that UBC pays for it because, like, their name is on it and it's on campus and, like, they get so much, like, press for it and stuff like that. But it's actually multiple different pathways. They apply for municipal funding from the Vancouver Foundation. They apply for provincial funding from the province. And then they apply for federal funding from Canadian Heritage and also from Canadian Council for the Arts. And then since Jennifer is a faculty worker, because she's also an associate professor, she's paid under like the Faculty of the Arts because as well as the director of the museum.
So you're saying that the MOA doesn't, like, it's not fully funded by UBC?
Yeah, like barely. I would say like their support from UBC is through like plant operations and like maybe just the fact that there is like a university, so like students.
That's so interesting because I feel like we talked about this last time, but UBC uses the MOA as such a draw to come here.
Yeah.
But then in reality, it's like a fully functioning institution of its own.
Yeah, and it is like it's a world renowned museum like on its own too. So then I got into kind of how does your job look different to that of an art curator in like a typical white box gallery. And we talked about, she explained to me a classic exhibit that happened at the Center for African Art in New York City called Art/Artifact. And I'm quoting her like directly here, but what it did was it showed objects from Africa in different contextualized ways throughout the exhibit. So it started with what you might assume with like a cabinet of curiosity, which is when white people show other people's objects in sort of unfamiliar ways. They shut them into a container. So it's all about the curious, the strange, the grotesque. And then it moved to the ethnographic, where you get photographs of the original people, how something might have been used within the culture. And then they took something that could have been seen in either of those ways, and either in the curiosity cabinet or the ethnographic display, and they put it into a white box and like wrapped it in a net and put it on a pedestal in a white room with lights and very little description. And then, like, suddenly it's, like, a sculpture or, like, yeah, it's a sculpture. It takes on a new meaning. And basically the point of that is that it shows how you display objects changes the meaning of how they're valued or understood, which, like, is super obvious. But I think she kind of got me a little bit because I was trying to ask, like, oh, is it different because you're working with, like, different cultures, which is like another kind of like heavy word, I guess. But and she got me there because she said like it's not so much about like this culture versus that culture as it is just like different museums display things differently and people have different intentions when they walk in based on like how they value things and how they see them.
That's awesome. That's a really good answer on her part, I think.
Yeah. No, yeah. There were a couple times where I thought I was asking, like, I guess, like, an unbiased question, and she was like, no.
But that's why she's the curator.
Yeah, yeah. And then I asked, like, how do your duties and responsibilities as a curator differ from, like, non-UBC art institutions? So I guess I could be compared to, like, the VAG or, like, the James Blake?
James Black, yeah.
James Black Gallery. And so she was saying that in other spaces, the curator often feels like kind of entitled to the pieces and they can decide what they want to say about it and how they want to present it. But at the MOA, that's not how they feel. And they try to work with the artist and the community to make sure they're conveying a display space that is what the community wants to be displayed. One example of this is, like, the Multiversity Galleries, which is, like, a huge collection. If you've been to the Museum of Anthropology, it's, like, takes, like, definitely more than an hour to, like, walk through. And it's, like, belongings from all around the world. And she told me something that was pretty interesting about that, and that was that originally they had just put everything out. They were going to have it's just kind of like neutral. They were thinking like, oh, we'll have people come and draw their own meanings from this. And then in 2003, a Canadian Foundation for Innovation grants was based on the idea called A Partnership in People's New Infrastructure for Collaborative Research. And then one of the projects was to redo visible storage and redo it with what the MOA calls communities of origin. So meaning with the communities whose material culture is held in the collection. And Jennifer was saying that she feels like for the Multiversity Galleries, they were mostly successful in like accomplishing this, especially for British Columbia and First Nations, because they have a lot of means to work with those communities. But that other curators who were working farther away had kind of different experiences and different pathways and stuff. And the one thing I did want to shout out was that she's curating the New Hulk exhibit. She's been working on that for a long time, and it is up and happening now, and it's open until January of 2026. And, she was a co-curator with Clyde Talia, who is New Hulk. And, yeah, it's super cool. I got to check it out, and I do recommend.
Yeah, I mean, just, like, touching on the MOA as well from what you were saying, I have a professor who curates the African art section at the MOA, and he was even saying how a lot of the times, especially within the African art section, because these objects have been displaced so for so many generations and so many years, the information doesn't travel with them. So many of the objects, and I'm sure with Indigenous collections and just everywhere around the world, they have a lot of question marks on the info cards with them. So even the curators and the highest, like, people with the highest knowledge within the MOA sometimes don't even know the information where these, like, objects come from, which I find really interesting. Because you'd think that if you're in a museum, like, you trust what you read most of the time. And by adding a question mark, it shows, oh, did these, like, higher powers even really know as much as the general public, pretty much?
I think also the question mark kind of, like, shows that it is, like, a continuous thing. Like, it's like they will continue to know more about how, like, that community wants to be represented and stuff like that. And, like, the agency of, like, the belongings and treasures and stuff. But, yeah, I would say that that kind of, like, wraps it up perfectly, because her final thought was that there's no right or wrong way to well, there's definitely a wrong way, but kind of in like, a contained sense. But there's no right or wrong way as a curator, whether you're curating art or anthropology or something completely else. Each time it's a representation. It'll never wholly be everything. It can't. This is too big of a question.
That's great. Thank you so much, Mickey. And thank you again to Dr. Kramer, too. That sounded like a really insightful conversation. And I really like that ending note about how it's like it can never be everything. We're going to go into an interview here with someone from the James Black Gallery. Margaret, would you like to introduce the interview?
Yeah, of course. So my interview is with Zandi Dandizet, who is a multidisciplinary artist in their own right, as well as the director of the James Black Gallery, which is a queer and artist-run center operating out of a beautiful little heritage building in the Mount Pleasant neighborhood of Vancouver. So I'm super excited about this interview. I think it speaks for itself.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah.
I just wanted to jump in there and say that James Black is like a really interesting space because it is like artist-led and artist-run, just as Western Front is another one in Vancouver. And Vancouver actually has a really rich history of these artist-run spaces, I think, because there has been so much like anti-institutional art in Vancouver, especially in like the 80s and 90s, coupled with like the rest of the PNW, Seattle, Portland. And yeah, it's really like such a privilege that we get to talk to James Black about this. They put on some great events. There's actually one happening tomorrow. That's perfect timing with anarchists and CITR, Unseated Airwaves, and the Women's Center as well. So it's actually super awesome. It's called Rooting Resistance. Maya, would you like to speak to that a little bit more?
Rooting Resistance. It's a 3-day workshop screening an event series. And first event is tomorrow at the CIRS Hydro Theater here on the UBC campus, 4:30 to 7:30. Tomorrow we're going to be talking about occupation in Musqueam and screening a couple little things for that, and following that with a zine workshop. So please
super
be
awesome.
There.
Yeah, all right. We're going to head into the interview now. Thank you so much.
So I just wanted to ask you a little couple questions. I think if you'd want to introduce yourself and basically just maybe describe your role as the director of the James Black Gallery.
Yeah. So my name is Zandy Dandazet. I am the executive director of the James Black Gallery. I'm originally from Portland, Oregon. I came up here to go to school for animation in 2011, and I do have a degree in that. I am a new media interdisciplinary artist, as well as the work that I do at the JBG. The James Black Gallery itself is a queer-led arts and culture hub dedicated to supporting multidisciplinary emerging and early career artists. We try to view our programming as responsive to the ever-shifting needs of our community and thinking about being a space that can nurture community connection, as well as be kind of like a bouncing off or starting point for artists, which can be kind of hard to find in Vancouver, right? We are located in a house. I originally lived there at one point. It used to be a group living situation. I moved in at the tail end of another collective called Grops in 2014, which had kind of fallen apart. It was at the ending point of that collective, and we were told we had a few months left. It was going to be renovicted, and that's kind of what spurred it. It was too beautiful space to ignore, and just really wanted to put on one art show. And that's kind of the starting off point of the JBG, to be honest.
Okay. My follow-up question there was to ask you if there was any specific impetus or like motivation to create the James Black Gallery. And I'm assuming it was because it was maybe going to be destroyed or renovated.
Yeah, I should say, I was told that it was an artist-run center when I moved in. It was not. I had always daydreamed of living in an art collective. When I first walked up the steps of the JBG in 2013, I was like, I'm going to live here. This is the spot. The week I finished university was when I moved in there. And so when we were told we were kind of on the chopping block, it seemed like it would have been sad not to see it used at least one time. And so I did kind of a big call for submissions. We had artists from, at the time I was pretty tapped into like a digital network. So we had artists from 9 different countries participate, as well as a lot of local artists. So it was kind of really neat. And I would say energetically infusing to all the residents who lived there at the time with me. And that's kind of how we started doing it.
That's awesome. Were any of the original residents continue on with you with the creation of the gallery?
Yeah, quite a few for a bit. There's actually someone named Darian Blake who moved on to being an arborist, and he comes and helps take care of our trees every summer and is still involved in that way. We actually have one of our current studio members is one of the like original few residents. And so, you know, we do have people who are involved still, you know, do visit from time to time with sort of like nostalgic viewpoints.
That's wonderful. And I understand you guys have been operating for more than 10 years now, right? Like officially as the gallery.
Yeah. So it would have been December 2014 was the first show. We didn't become a nonprofit till 2018, though. It took us a while to kind of figure out a path or trajectory that we wanted to take, especially as we were in that sort of like chaotic unknown of how long do we have, right? Which we still are not going to be there forever. Learning to like take looking at the future with more intention and also not burnout of like doing things really fast and quickly, right? It's been kind of interesting to navigate that.
I feel like this ties in a bit to what we're trying to get at here at with the arts collectors, that we're trying to figure out in what ways does the art institution, like as an ecosystem, kind of operate, and where do you see the gallery kind of fitting into this ecosystem? Like, is it on the periphery? Is it like outside completely? Do you understand where I'm getting at with this question a bit?
No, totally. To be honest, maybe some of that confusion is something that's also visible from the inside.
Okay.
I would say about 2 years ago, we did our first sort of like visioning session. And it was that we kind of operate in between third space and institution, and trying to navigate that line, because I think third spaces are so crucial and important, but you do have this sort of like push to behave in certain ways in order to be taken seriously, that then lends its value to artists and you know, whether you're your space is on their CV or not, right? Or whether we can get grants that then fund and support artists, right? So we kind of have, I would say, like a little bit of, you know, maybe a mask in some ways of like having to perform in some ways and others trying to be intentional in that way as well, if that makes sense.
That does make sense, yeah. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, it's actually why the James Black Gallery is named as such, because as you may know, if you visit the space in person, it doesn't really have the same identity as the name maybe presents itself when you approach it online. And that partially was did have to do with us trying to get these like institutional systems to trust us. James Black is also the man who built the house originally. He was the carpenter. So our intention with it, the name, was both sort of to obfuscate this like dilapidated bright blue house, but externally, but also to kind of like recognize the fact that we are building upon other people's work and not sort of, you know, I think the thing is when you are identified as like a founder or executive director, you get given a lot of credit for things. And there's so much that has been done by all of the people involved and around in the space as well, right? Not just myself.
Yes, that's a good point. I'm curious about when you said that in some ways, like the James Black Gallery, the fact you guys have that name that maybe doesn't really fit your actual vibe, but it's also maybe still an advantage for people to have that kind of official sounding name. Do you view the gallery as providing like a stepping stone for artists and like its allowance of like new emerging artists to practice like holding an exhibition, get their foot in the door? Or do you view it more as like it trying to create and empower like a completely almost alternate art space or art world? Or do you think it's a bit of both?
I think people approach us with different ideas, right, of what they want. And, you know, there's something about both curation and having sort of like a white walls gallery space where there's this idea that you kind of like take people and put them in a space and it be about maybe like what you as the institution or you as the curator want, which can be kind of white supremacist in its aim, right? And so what I hope and attempt to do is offer people space so that they can vision their reality. So some people do approach it with it being the stepping stone towards their future. This is like a trial run or like your first time doing a workshop. We actually had an artist who participated in a group show in high school, and they then once they finished university, did their very first exhibition there because they wanted to return to the space in which they had their first show and see how much they have like shifted and grown in their work, right? Mm-hmm. But we also do have other folks who participate in our pod residencies. And the pod residency series is about sort of like examining the process with each other and like coming together and discovering new ideas and ways of being, right? And so I think partially it's dependent on the series and partially dependent on what people are seeking from us that we try to support and navigate around.
Okay. Yeah, it sounds like you're a lot more, well, I mean, obviously receptive to the specific needs of specific artists. That's cool.
Yeah. I, you know, especially when you're working with experimental and multidisciplinary practices, there's going to be such different approaches to things, right?
No, that makes a lot of sense. We're very curious about how your experience working within and working for the gallery has changed your own, well, let's say personal beliefs concerning art as an artist yourself?
With the length of time I've been involved with the space, that's a really interesting one. I do think that when I was younger, I was very stubborn and headstrong about these ideas of achievement, being someone who grew up as an American and you know, probably had a few chips on my shoulder. I would say that that definitely has shifted. I have always had a desire to see community and be a part of something. And I think moving to Vancouver was very challenging because I could not see myself or find myself in the world around me. So I think part of what, you know, inspired me to keep on doing this was to see a space in which it was something that I could see myself be a part of, right? Mm-hmm. I do think now, over the years, I've seen different spaces that are that too, but, you know, kind of carving out a space in which the future and the world I want to see exists, right?
That's a beautiful response. Yeah. I also wanted to ask one last question. What has been the most interesting and unexpected, I guess, art exhibition that you've had?
Yeah. Oh, wow. There's been quite a few. You know, something that isn't so novel now, but was at the time, back in 2017, we did a show called IRL URL, which you've heard of shows like that. So it's not really, like I said, not so novel now. But at the time, we really wanted to kind of push even further the relationship between digital and physical connection. And in that show, we had it live streamed so that some of the artists who were somewhere else could witness and be a part of the show from afar, which was really neat. We also, the front porch area, we actually completely draped in black fabric. So it was sort of like this like separation space between the external and the internal. And usually that place was really loud and boisterous. People would be smoking cigarettes, that kind of thing. And we found by doing this sort of like putting a blanket over a birdcage sort of element that people would be like whisper talking out there and just be like sitting in like this like relaxed silence as like the entries to the space while the inside was boisterous and loud, right?
I think it's wonderful that the space is like providing opportunity in terms of what you can do with your art instead of maybe being a bit more restrictive or just predictable.
Yeah, I have seen people get to try something that they have never really done in their art, and that becomes a new thing that they lead down a whole entire path or trajectory, or build a new collaborative relationship that they didn't have before. I've also seen people do something one time that you'll never get to see do again. That's really unique, but not maybe something that makes them money in the same way. I would say that this has been something that's informed my art practice, or I should say my curatorial practice. I would also say that our Inverted Pyramid series, which is actually a new set of it, is coming up and going to be curated by our newest staff member, Anata Lailai. That series is all about people getting a chance to do something that they want to do versus what they are expected to do. So
that's wonderful. So happy to hear about that. Okay, that wraps up all of my questions for you. I want to thank you again for taking the time to meet and to chat. I'm really happy.
All right, thank you so much, and welcome back to CITR 101.9 FM. You're listening to the Arts or Collective, the Art Beat by the Arts Collective, and this is our limited series called Everything But the Piece. That was a wonderful interview with Zandy from the James Black Gallery, and one of the things that stuck out to me from that was talking about how the name James Black was like just put on the collective, the artist collective, to kind of try to cater to that like institutional reputation and make it seem a little bit more legitimate than it is. And I don't know, thinking about that kind of thing is so funny and so interesting.
Yeah, I mean, that worked on me. Like, when I heard of, first heard of the James Black Gallery, I was imagining, like, one of those, like, all-white liminal spaces. And it turns out to just be, like, a really cute little, like, place in Mount Pleasant. It's blue. So their advertising campaign, like, worked incredibly, if you ask me.
It's interesting. I think it helps it reach a different audience than it usually would, which is exactly what we hope these kinds of spaces can do.
Totally. Yeah.
For sure. And another thing that I really, really enjoyed was how, if anything, the physical space itself is like one of its biggest strengths. The fact that it's this space that you can use the outside porch area, the basement, what have you, like artists are really allowed to kind of explore how they would want their art to be in a physical space. Whereas I feel like maybe other galleries have a lot more restraints, whereas the James Black Gallery really lets you get loose a little bit.
And yet that kind of makes you start thinking about the impact the physical institution has on the art itself.
Totally.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you feel that difference in the space, and in some way that kind of feeds the art.
Yeah, kind of how, like, art has to conform to the institutional spaces in typical galleries.
And even going back to the whole Banksy concept, like, I wonder what it would have been like to see his work outside of this, like, gallery setting, and how that would have struck me differently if I happened down the street and was like, oh my gosh, there's a Banksy.
Hi, my name's James Black, and you're listening to the Art Beat.
That's pretty much everything we have for today. So thank you so much, James Black, for being here. And thank you, everyone, for listening. So
thank
have
you.
A good
thank
night.
A person with HIV can now live a long, healthy life thanks to treatment. But the first step is to get tested. The sooner you know your HIV status, the better. You can now test yourself at home with just a prick of the finger and get results within a minute. Order a free HIV self-test kit online at selftest.catie.ca. That's selftest.catie.ca. Your health is at your fingertips. A message from CATIE. Canada.
In the context of Vancouver's opioid crisis, CITR would like to take a moment to share some harm reduction strategies.
Try not to do drugs alone. When going out, let friends know what drugs you're taking and make sure someone has an naloxone kit. If you're able to, get your drugs tested before taking them.
Avoid mixing opioids with alcohol or stimulants. Remember that opioids can include painkillers prescribed by a doctor, and it's possible for any drugs to be contaminated with opioids.
Learn the signs of opioid overdose, which include, but are not limited to, unresponsiveness or unconsciousness, inability to speak, breathing that is slow, erratic, or has stopped completely, heartbeat that is slow, erratic, or has stopped completely, skin tone that has turned blue or gray, choking or gurgling sounds.
If you think someone is overdosing, call 911 immediately.
Stephen Hamm, and you are listening to CITR 101.9, home of the theremin.
Zimmerman, I'm doing fine. Thanks for dropping me a line. And I